This is the Marketing Podcast Network.
Welcome to Uncorking a Story, the podcast that introduces you to the rich world of storytellers who share their personal journeys, creative processes, and the stories behind their stories, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be part of your writing journey. If you're an aspiring writer, a literary enthusiast, or simply someone who believes in the transformative power of words, you've come to the right place. Every week, we'll pop the cork on the world of successful storytellers and give you a healthy pour of inspiration, insight, and empowerment. My mission is to help writers like you realize your full potential through the transformative and therapeutic power of writing. Whether you're just starting your literary voyage or looking to refine your craft, I'm here to provide you with the knowledge, inspiration, and encouragement you need to embark on your own storytelling adventure. So, are you ready to uncork your story and let your creativity flow? Uncorking a Story is about to begin. Sit back, relax, and let the transformative magic of storytelling whisk you away. Welcome to Uncorking a Story. Richard Roper is a writer and freelance book editor. He's the author of Something to Live For and When We Were Young. He joins me today on Uncorking a Story to talk about his career and his latest book, This Disaster Loves You. Welcome to Uncorking a Story, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Richard, I'm happy to have you here. Very excited. Tell me, where does your story as an author begin?
So whenever I'm asked this question, I always feel quite guilty that I've occasionally been on panels with other authors and they've talked about how their sort of journey as an author started when they were about five and they wrote their first sort of epic poem on the side of a cereal box or something. And they've always dreamed of being an author since day one. And I kind of didn't. And I think partly that was because while I always loved books as a kid and reading, and I studied English at university, I didn't ever really sort of see myself as a writer at all. I don't really know why, to be honest, but it was only really after I got a job working in publishing where I started as a nonfiction editorial assistant and worked my way up to being a commissioning editor for a publishing house in London, that I started to become more aware of the kind of, I suppose, the background behind books and how they're written and how they were published. And I think, you know, my day-to-day life was just so books-oriented, and I was being given book recommendations all the time. And I kind of rediscovered my kind of love of fiction, even though I was working in nonfiction. I think I desperately wanted to kind of escape from the books I was working on, which were fun to work on, but I just couldn't read any more nonfiction. So I sort of rediscovered a love of fiction in particular. And it was quite a kind of, I spent a few idle weekends just working on things, short stories and bits and pieces, purely to kind of entertain myself. And it kind of grew from there. So it's not the most romantic answer, I'm afraid, but I kind of almost became an author by accident, I think.
Well, when you were younger, what did you want to be? Did you have any career aspirations when you were a kid?
Again, not really. And it's such the anyone who I think has gone off and studied English literature at university, you know, you're not going into that because you are, I don't think anyway, you've got a career plan. You are a lazy art student who wants to read books for a few years and then you come out at the end of it and you think, I now better find a way of making a living. Publishing kind of came out of that, really. There wasn't really anything else. I mean, I was in a succession of terrible bands when I was about 14, 15, which it never quite went well together because I'm going to loosely term it punk bands, but when you're growing up in just outside Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire, it's hard to kind of write songs about giving the middle finger to the man because, you know, you haven't got many problems in your life. So there's probably a reason why I turned to books in the end.
What? So you said punk bands. What drew you into punk music?
I think it was, I think like most people, you sort of, when you first learning those kind of musical tastes, you're influenced by what you're sort of friends are listening to. And I think there's always like one kid in the group who sort of almost is really into a kind of particular genre of music. And in this case, it was my friend Ben. And I think that everyone sort of kind of crowded around him as the kind of popular kid. And he was into sort of punk music. And it was kind of, I mean, this was sort of about, we're talking kind of just turn of the millennium, where that kind of Californian skate punk was the sort of the music that, you know, all my friends are listening to. So then, again, as I say, trying to kind of do our version of that in a little genteel village in England didn't quite work, but it was certainly a really fun time in my life playing in those bands. And it's still, I think, I was speaking to someone the other day who talked about music in terms of it being like a time machine, in that, you know, when you listen to songs now that I think that you listen to for the first time or were really into in that period between sort of 14 and 20, maybe, it's such a kind of link back to those days. So there's a reason why half the music on my Spotify is sort of remains from that period, and it's the songs I'll never skip. So I think it's, you know, it's about the music, but also kind of getting linked back to that time in your life as well.
Yeah, that's how I feel about like heavy metal music, you know, just kind of growing up in the 80s. Iron Maiden was like my go-to, and I love their music still to today, even though, you know, for some reason, as I'm approaching 50, I'm starting to listen to like 70s soft rock, which really freaks me out a little bit. But like, I'll find myself driving in the car listening to like Gordon Lightfoot and like really enjoying every minute of it. But then like, there's this other side to me, which is like, hey man, remember when you used to listen to like, Iron Maiden, Seven Son of a Seven Son album, like every single day. And I'm like, yeah, that guy's still there. But for some reason, as I'm getting older, like, I don't know, I listen to like yacht rock. It's crazy how your tastes change over time.
Yeah, it's a weird one. And I think it's just listening to, I think there would be a time when I could just put some shuffle on my music and it would generally fall in the kind of same space now. But it's quite the thing, you know, if you've been out somewhere, I'm sitting on the top deck of the bus listening to music after having had a couple of drinks with some friends, which is generally my favorite time to listen to music. I put shuffle on and suddenly I'm going from sort of Debussy to No Effect. It's quite a strange kind of mixture of things, so it'd be a bit disorientating. But yeah, but I liked that your kind of music taste kind of evolves. I think it's maybe your younger self and this future self battling to see who's going to come out on top in the end.
All right. Well, let's jump into talking about your writing. So when did you start to think, hey, I'm going to, you know, try my hand at writing something, writing something original? When did that creep into your mind?
So I think after I started sort of kind of doodling almost with these little short stories and just kind of a lot of the time writing things that I wanted to do to make people laugh, just, you know, doing stuff with friends, really. I then sort of thought to myself, well, I had an idea for a book, and I just thought, well, I'm just going to start writing this, and with a kind of vague aim that I'm going to try and write a certain amount of words every day and get to the end of it and see what I've got. And again, there was no sort of real plan other than that. I didn't, and in particular as well, in contrast to how I write books now, I didn't plan out the book at all. I just kind of went for it, which is why it ended up being, you know, 85,000 words and a bit of a mess, really. So that would have been about 9 years ago now. And I did actually, I sort of spent a long time polishing that novel up. And I sent it out to some literary agents, and that book got sent around every single publisher in town, and to use the great euphemism of every literary agent, I didn't quite find a home. And so then I kind of was back to the drawing board after sort of 2 weeks of walking around like it was the worst thing that ever happened to anyone in the history of the world. And the one sort of really good bit of advice I'd been given about when you're submitting a book is that when that book is out on submission, you should start doing something else so that you're A, distracted, and B, you're sort of almost half preparing yourself for the, you know, very realistic possibility that the book, you know, might not get picked up by anyone, so that you're almost, you've grieved that thing and you're moving on and you're trying to do the next thing. So I then spent about another year writing a second novel, and I got to the end of that, and I just found myself thinking, I'm not sure this is the one either. I can't really work out why. Again, I think it was because I hadn't in any way tried to evolve my writing process in terms of how I approached the craft of it. I just sort of went again. And I think it was that realization that I hadn't, you know, it was a different story, but this, for whatever reason, I just had a hunch, a sense that it wasn't the one. So I was at that point kind of ready to, not maybe to give up, but just say, you know, I didn't quite know what I was going to do next. And then I was very lucky that an idea came to me just from a very idle day when I was reading a news story I found on my lunch break work. And this would have been in 2017. And that, and also in line with how I'd read a book that kind of changed my life, really, and particularly when it came to writing, which is a book called Into the Woods by a writer called John York, which is kind of an extraordinary book about how stories are made, why we love stories, how stories work and why they don't work sometimes. And it was a real kind of lightning bolt moment of having a new idea for a book and having what felt like the kind of cheat codes in a way to working out how to write a successful structure, how to write compelling characters. And I'm so sort of excited with this new knowledge I had that I then went ahead and wrote that book. And luckily that was the one that got picked up. So it was a little bit of a journey to get there, but yeah, I'm glad I got there in the end.
So yeah, two tries, right? Two, what we would say, two at bats. And those didn't go anywhere. And then it was this third one that did. And that's not an uncommon story. I mean, I hear authors talking all the time about how, hey, their first one didn't sell, their second one didn't sell, but, you know, the third one or the fourth one or whatever, you know, did. But it sounds like this book, Into the Woods, was really impactful. And I'm curious, you use the term cheat codes. Why do you say cheat codes?
I suppose it's because once I read that book, everything fell into place in terms of, oh, there's a reason why the first book I wrote hadn't, well, there are many reasons why it didn't necessarily work. The writing, I think, was okay. It was, you know, I think I've read so much, and having just sort of practiced with short stories and everything, I had got the building blocks of sentences and paragraphs. And, you know, there was obviously a plot there, but I think being made aware from reading Into the Woods about the things that when we're watching movies or reading books, the things that have to be in place 99% of the time for a reader or a viewer to connect with a story or a character, having those pointed out and then just being given a route to how to apply, you know, a story that I'd written, but applying a structure and creating characters that kind of fit with what I'd read in that book, it felt like to me, oh, this is a kind of a magic trick, because, you know, once you know what works with structure, you can then, there is, and I hesitate to use the word, like, you know, formula, because that doesn't work. And I'm very much, you know, I know that there are people that really do sort of say, well, you know, this had to happen on page X or whatever, you know, you can't approach it like that. But it felt like it was just a complete shift in my dynamics of how I wrote and how I was able to plan books, which I now do, so that, you know, literally the idea of thinking about, okay, here is how the protagonist is going to appear on page one, and here's how they're going to appear on the final page, and having that to start with, and just thinking, okay, what is the shift going to be and why? And once you sort of know that everything is driven by a character in terms of what their flaws are, what their wants are, what their needs are, everything like that came together, just made me feel really excited about writing a new book. And it's always the book I recommend to new writers when I'm talking to them. And I really hope it sort of has had as dynamic an effect on them as it has on me.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, when you were in the punk bands, were you writing your own songs back then?
We were, yes. apart from a very ill-advised ska punk cover of Let's Go Fly a Kite, which I'm sorry to say does exist on an MP3 somewhere in the dark recesses of my laptop. I was a drummer, so I wasn't really writing much other than a bit of 1, 2, 3, 4. But I was quite, I think in general, though, we did kind of write our own stuff. And also we were really, you know, we recorded a EP when we were about 14, and I've still got it. And it's still kind of, you know, it's not good, but it still is a bunch of kids who were creating, you know, largely our own songs and could, you know, hold a tune and hold a rhythm. So yeah, I'm always look back fondly at those moments of kind of the first, I suppose, stirrings of creating something and having kind of people, you know, audience feedback of the sort.
Now, was the B-side to Let's Go Fly a Kite A Spoonful of Sugar? Did you try and attempt that one? Or
I knew you were going to say that. That's true. Too much politics. Yeah, I mean, that was what, you know, that was really the kind of the Paul and John moment that broke the pie, and that, you know, Ben wanted to get on that route, I didn't, and then it all just fell apart, really. So but where's our kind of Peter Jackson 10-part documentary? You know, it's such a shame. There we go.
I know, but you know, that documentary was a lot of Yoko knitting. You know, it was just like her sitting in the corner just being a distraction, and I just couldn't get, I, you know, I had to stop at one point. I'm like, the sweater has to be done soon, you know?
Whatever. That was what I really loved so much of that kind of mundanity. And I could have honestly watched about 30 more hours of that. Not obviously, you know, when you're watching Paul Wright Get Back in real time, that is amazing. But I just loved it for bits where, you know, he would turn to John and say, hey, we could get some more ham sandwiches in here. Look up, see. And he would sort of feel like, why are they all just sitting around having sandwiches and cups of tea? Isn't it kind of rock and roll and they're all, but no, they just, it was so kind of English and genteel. I loved it. So I would happily watch about 20 more hours of it.
I don't want to get any more sandwiches, Paul.
There you go.
I just want to ignore George some more.
With his sad little face, is George one of us. I think that's me done in with Eagles now. Very fast.
I asked about songwriting because I'm curious, is, you know, you mentioned, you know, this book, which helped you with structure with, you know, writing, you know, long form fiction. I'm just curious, like, is there a parallel to songwriting, the structure of songwriting and structure to writing long form fiction?
It's a good question. I think that definitely, I suppose when you are, when songwriters are approaching a song, they might have the spark for, I guess, you know, a melody, or maybe it's a lyric. And then I suppose it's a case then of trying to, use that in a strong structure. And I guess people must approach it in different ways. You know, I'm always intrigued when you hear interviews with musicians about whether, particularly I think ones where you have a separate vocalist and songwriter who maybe goes away and writes poetry, and then it's a case of putting that to the music. And, you know, something like, I think the Smiths in particular is an example of a band where it feels like that must have happened, because Johnny Marr's kind of melodies are so kind of, okay, you know, out there and unique, and I think, and were so different to what other people were doing at the time. And then you had Morrissey writing, you know, these really kind of, these almost poems, really. And I'm fascinated to know kind of how that kind of collaboration works. And I suppose unless you are, you know, those, I know that there are authors out there who collaborate together and write books. I'm always fascinated to how that works. But then I suppose there's also, you know, I'm very lucky in that I've got a brilliant editor who I work with, who, you know, there's that kind of relationship, I suppose, when you're trying to then, you know, there are compromises you have to make. And, you know, taking on feedback. So, yeah, I'm sure there are parallels there.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when your first book came out, how did your life change, you know, from that point forward?
Well, it was, I mean, I'm really pleased in, to go back to what I was saying earlier about how I'd gone through the experience of having books rejected before the one that got picked up, because it sort of it grounded me in that sense of, you know, when you're writing, the thing to keep coming back to it, the most enjoyable thing about the whole process is when you are locked in a, you know, in the world of a character and you're spending an hour just forgetting about the rest of the world. It's almost like a mindfulness exercise where you are just, you know, approaching a character. And I love the moments where, you know, either found a plot point that's going to work, or a character says something that I like, or just a little joke. And it, as much as getting that first book deal changed my life in the sense that it meant I could change my career to go down to part-time at my day job, and it meant, you know, some financial stability. At the end of it all, what's really changed my life is that having those been given more freedom to be creative and to spend time in my happy place, which is those moments where I've sort of spent my, you know, day largely with my head in my hands trying to work out a plot hole or something, and then just for that spark of, oh, this is how I could fix that, or having, you know, the initial idea for a book when I'm out on a walk, that is the thing that's kind of has changed my life. And I know, as I'm saying that, I realize it sounds like quite a corny answer, but I hope it doesn't come across like that. It's just, I think it's just that I have to remind myself occasionally, if I'm ever, you know, grumbling about something to do with the publishing process, which can be a very frustrating industry to be part of, just the fact that it gives me license to be creative for a living is an absolute godsend. So I'm really grateful for that.
And I imagine just giving you the confidence too, to know that you've done it before, you can do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point, because there are moments, I mean, I'm just about to start, or I'm kind of working up the idea for my fourth book now. And I had a day last week where I was just sort of staring at what, you know, the notes I got written. And I just, it's almost seemed incomprehensible to me that I'd ever written anything before, because I just thought, this is never going to become anything. But then being able to take a moment just to sort of say, well, you felt like this with every single book you've written so far. So being able to kind of remember that and not, you know, it's easy, I think, to kind of just to give up, because you sort of think, oh, well, you know, I'm never going to do this again. But yeah, having sort of prior same experience and being able to recognize that and sort of saying, you know, you will kind of, there will be light at the end of the tunnel with this, and it'll be something you're proud of, is always a really kind of, yeah, a motivating factor.
You know, you mentioned kind of an idea for a book coming to you when you're out on a walk. Where does your inspiration come from, and where do you turn to for sources of inspiration?
It's a good question. I think it's, there's never really been a system I use in terms of, where I look for ideas or how I kind of work out the ones develop, but a lot of them come from stories and, you know, that I read in the newspaper or online. That was certainly the case for Something to Live For, my first novel, which was just sort of, you know, scrolling through all the tabs I'm looking at on a kind of, you know, all the just the website, just for sort of stuff to distract me. And this story appeared about what happens in a local housing authority in the north of England, where someone has died alone and there isn't a next of kin, and it followed someone on their day-to-day life about how they about what kind of, you know, their daily job, and it was a fascinating article, and it just, that was something that I thought, well, that's a fascinating character. And kind of, you know, already, and then just trying to find a plot or a kind of the hook that then went with that. So definitely that is something that I look out for. And a lot of the time it's, yeah, I think it's really important to, as a creative, to have kind of downtime where you're just reading books, watching films, watching TV shows, and just kind of becoming inspired again, and not necessarily being directly influenced by a single thing, but it could just be a sensibility or, you know, just from a TV show you've watched where you think, oh, I really want to write something that's, you know, a dark comedy next, or something that has a slightly kind of time trippy element or whatever it is, something like that, which then kind of inspires the general kind of direction. And then that's always the fun part, I think, because once you're vaguely aware of the what kind of route you're going to go down, then sort of, you know, okay, thinking, right, well, which character is going to appear here? And, you know, what are the big plot points? The thing I'm always, I find really helpful to have in place when I'm approaching a first draft is that having a plan in place, but having three or four big scenes that I'm really excited to write about. And it kind of gives you those sort of, those kind of posts in the distance where you're just looking out for that little blinking light where you think, if I can just get to that scene, I can write that scene, which I'm really looking forward to. So that's always the thing I'm, in particular, you know, the next couple of weeks while I'm working on this new idea, I'm seeking out those big scenes to write. And yeah, I'm looking forward to taking it from there.
Yeah. It's almost like you're a little reward, right? To get you to that spot. Cause I know some authors will go ahead and write those scenes first and then go back and write everything that leads up to them. But it sounds like for you, it's, hey, that's almost like a light at the end of the tunnel, and you want to get through that tunnel first.
Yeah. I might kind of write down, you know, my sort of emails are full of emails I've sent to myself at 4 a.m. when I can't sleep. And I look in the next day and I have absolutely no idea what it is. It will just be someone, you know, some sentence that sort of said, that's not my sandwich or something. And then I'm suddenly supposed to work back and think, what is the point in this? And then I'll realize, oh, that's going to be, some sort of stupid joke that will appear in that big scene that will. So I will allow myself little snippets or kind of, you know, whether it's a quote of dialogue or whether it's a bit of description or something. But no, I need that excitement, as you say, has to be there. In the same way that when I'm relatively disciplined when I'm writing a draft where I will try and do 1,000 words on a writing day. But at the end of that, I'll give myself a few bullet points to kind of for what I'm going to write the next day, which gives me a bit of sort of it. So you're not kind of beginning at a standing start when you're trying to get going the next day. So yeah, but having things to look forward to, I think, is in a draft or in a plot in a plan is really useful for me.
Well, speaking of things to look forward to, why don't we talk about This Disaster Loves You? What can you share with us about your latest?
Great, yeah. And so this is my new novel, published in February, and it is the story, tells the story of a man called Brian who runs a pub on the south coast of England called County Arms, which he did run with his wife Lily. But 7 years ago, she vanished off the face of the earth. And the only evidence for knowing that she's still okay was that she sent him a postcard saying that she was going away and she wasn't sure when she was coming back. And Brian has lost hope to a certain extent that she ever will come back and still doesn't quite know what's happened. And one day, as part of his daily task of looking at all the dreadful TripAdvisor reviews of his pub, which have sort of got worse over the years as he himself has fairly crumbled along with his pub. He's browsing through TripAdvisor and getting increasingly irate at the sorts of people that would leave reviews of anything. And he stumbles across a username, which in his heart, he knows belongs to his Lily. It's too unique to be for anyone else. And so he realizes that she's leaving reviews of different places around the UK. And so he decides that he's going to go off on a journey to try and track her down. And as he does so, we start to see the narrative that began when they first met. And we see kind of what went on between them up to the point where she left, and then follow Brian's journey as he tries to track Millie down.
Fascinating. And it's such a novel for an idea for this time.
Yeah.
You know, because of that, you know, TripAdvisor component and all that, like this wouldn't have come out 20 years ago. You couldn't have thought of this 20 years ago.
No, and back to your question earlier about being inspired by sort of how I, you know, get my ideas, I suppose. This one actually, it was one of the first times we were allowed to travel outside of whatever lockdown it was in 2021, 22, all the years blur into one, of course. And I was in, my girlfriend and I had gone on a trip up to York in the north of England, and we were sitting in a pub, and I was aware of a sort of slight I was going to say commotion, but this is Britain. So it was just people speaking quite loudly, but also incredibly politely with all the conversation happening between the gaps and all the subtext. And it was someone who was complaining about the service or the food they'd been served to this poor beleaguered proprietor who was out of shot. So I couldn't see him. I could just about see the person who was complaining. And obviously one of the great joys in life is sort of with no fault of your own, eavesdropping on conversations. And this, it was absolutely fascinating to hear this person complaining about everything and anything, to the point where at one point they invoked the Weights and Measures Act of 1985. And I just was so fascinated by this conversation and why this person was in, you know, they seemed to be almost relishing complaining so much. And this poor, you know, beleaguered man who was trying to sort of be polite. And I knew the rest of this trip away was entirely, you know, I was going around my girlfriend, you know, she was saying, oh, look at York Minster Cathedral. I think this has been here since the 14th century. And I was on my phone going, yeah. I'm just refreshing TripAdvisor to see if this person's left an online review of this pub. And lo and behold, they had. And it was this sort of monumental essay about, and it was just kind of fascinating. So after that, I mean, that was the kind of the idea for, you know, how I wanted to know why this proprietor was having to deal with this, and, you know, what might they just sounded so put off, as you can imagine. And then it also sent me down a really enjoyable rabbit hole that I'd highly recommend, of going on the TripAdvisor pages for things like the Grand Canyon or the Eiffel Tower, and sorting reviews by lowest to highest and seeing people's, you know, reviews of the Eiffel Tower and just sort of saying, it's not as big as I thought it was going to be, 1 star, or, you know, and each chapter in the book begins with a real TripAdvisor review of somewhere, which was, you know, what a joyful thing that was to be able to do at the end of the draft, which was to spend, you know, a whole day finding, you know, the worst reviews of Westminster Abbey or whatever. So yeah, that was a joy.
You know, I think, you know, there are 50 people who were able to maybe hear that or see that or witness that commotion. But only one of them, you know, was inspired to write a book about it. And I think that's what the superpower an author has. You know, of course, authors, you know how to put the right words on the page and structure and grammar. And I guess you could argue editors, you know, are for that stuff too. But to have that curiosity to take that flash of inspiration and then bring that through, you know, into a manuscript and then into a published work. To me, that's what the author's superpower is. It's that tapping into that curiosity and being aware that the universe is sending you this gift at that time.
Yeah, I think so. I think particularly it's maybe when it's hardest when you are a debut author, where you've sort of felt like you've not really, you're maybe not looking for those signs, or you're second guessing whether it's something that might work as a book or whether other people would even care about it. But that's why I feel like I'm always saying to new writers, if I'm giving advice to anyone about, you know, you have to write a book that you yourself would want to read. And if that's something that really interests you, or just something that you find fascinating about the world, or just, I don't know, whatever, you know, someone you see on your street, or somebody you walk past every day and you just wonder what their lives are like, and you feel compelled to write that story, then don't let anyone stop you doing that. You know, you should just follow exactly what it is that you want to write. And you know, we're all curious and about something, and we all have interests, and it's just really, following that and finding the joy in writing about the things that interest you, whatever it is.
Yeah. And then, you know, you never know, that one encounter you have could turn into a bestseller. So one of the things I'd like to do as we wrap up conversations is to get to know my guests a little bit more through pop culture. And we already talked about music, but I'm curious about movies and TV. When you were younger, what were some of the things you'd like to watch on either the big screen or the small screen?
Well, I was a huge comedy fan when I was a kid, and remain one. And I think that I'm probably at heart, I'm possibly a frustrated sitcom writer, and it's kind of my dad's influence, really, in that he was a huge comedy fan, and so even as a kid I was watching lots of kind of sitcoms that he loved from the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, kind of very, very British comedies, actually. And then as a teenager, you know, my sort of, it seems like a relic from a completely different time now, but the best time for me would be 9 o'clock on a Thursday evening, where that would be, you know, BBC Two or Channel Four would be showing episodes of whatever the sitcom of the day was. And something like the original, the UK version of The Office, for example. And I love the American one, don't get me wrong, but the UK one, I think something like that has probably influenced me more than any book I've ever read in terms of writing, because what I thought that show did so brilliantly was to create drama and comedy out of the most kind of mundane but yet recognizable situation. So it wasn't, you know, a show. I sort of felt like as a kid that creativity was about creating something that was otherworldly, or, you know, huge characters and, you know, something incredibly colorful. Whereas the sort of genius of a show like The Office, which is just the kind of little ticks of the human condition and the dynamics at play, and still managing to have, you know, what I think is the kind of the great love story with Tim and Dawn in the UK version. It, that to me was completely inspiring. So I was definitely watching, yeah, lots of comedy was my thing. And then that sort of transferred into me watching lots of live stand-up as well. And I was very lucky in that my job as a commissioning editor in the publishing world and nonfiction was commissioning lots of comedians. So I got to go up to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival every year, and going to that festival, which is the biggest comedy festival in the world, and sitting in these little rooms and watching, you know, burgeoning stars kind of announce themselves on the kind of world comedy stage was such a buzz. And I'm really sad that this will be the first year I won't be going for work. I might still go up there for pleasure. But so yeah, comedy and stand-up played a massive part of that. And I'd love one day to write something that's pure comedy, or maybe TV that's kind of comedy drama. And those shows are still the things that inspire me to write. I think when a new Fleabag or something similar comes along, or Barry, which I think is Bill Hader's show, which I think is one of the great shows of all time.
It's so dark. I have a hard time with Barry. I can't remember if season two or season three, just in the opening part of where he's debating whether or not he's got to kill a kid. And I'm like, yes. Oh, and I know that it turns out fine, but to me, just watching him struggle in that moment, and I love Bill Hader. I mean, everything he's done just, you know, usually makes me smile and laugh.
Yeah.
For me, like, that was like so intense. I had a hard time getting through it. I really did.
Well, what's so funny about that as well is that both that and that show, and I believe The Bear, which is also one of my favorite shows, but equally intense and at times almost impossible to watch because it's so awful and tense, everything, are then nominated in these sort of comedy shows, just like the Emmys or whatever. And it's such a sort of strange thing where you think, you know, are we really saying these are comedies? I think maybe they start slightly more comedic, and then that kind of gives the creators license to kind of go, right, well, you know, you laughed at these characters in the start, now we're going to kind of take them in a different direction. Although I've been rewatching probably for about the fifth time The Sopranos all the way through. And I had forgotten just how funny that show is. I mean, obviously there are the sort of slightly more overly-ish comedic episodes like Pine Barrens is obviously the famous one with Paulie and Chris in the woods, which is full of some of the great lines. But every single episode there is a line that will make me laugh out loud sprinkled through. And I think that is what, you know, in all the great dramas, there are moments of comedy. In all the great comedies, there are moments of drama. And I don't think you can really separate them out like that. But yeah, it's been a really gleeful rewatch of The Sopranos in particular.
I still want to know what happened to the Russian at the end of that Pine Barrens episode. They leave it up to the imagination, but I really want to know.
Well, I did read, because I listened to, I think maybe just out of lockdown, I listened to Michael Imperioli and Steve Schirripo play Christopher and Bobby, did a sort of rewatch podcast of, you know, the end of the show. And they had, I can't remember if it was a theory or they're quite mischievous. So I don't know whether they were just throwing this in as a completely false story, but they had heard that David Chase had planned with the Russian that he was going to come back in a future series, but he would be sort of brain damaged. So he would be back with the other kind of Russian guys. But so that Paulie Crisp would walk into this office and they would see him and lock eyes with him, but he wouldn't recognize them. And so it was kind of them working out, well, is he going to kind of, what the hell's going to happen here? But I sort of prefer the version where, you know, he's just sort of this mythical being that's off somewhere and has somehow escaped. But yeah, what a joyful episode, Dallas.
Yeah, it was great. You know, I'm curious, Richard, if you could go back in time and whisper some words of advice into your younger self's ear, what would you tell your younger self?
Oh, that's a great question. I think definitely, I mean, it's quite an obvious one, but I think I would tell myself to believe in myself a little bit more. And I think I'm someone, and I still have to tell myself this occasionally, I quite often will wait for other people to make the first move in terms of so many areas of life without kind of realizing that, oh no, I could do that. I could be the one to write a book. I could, you know, be your smallest things like, well, I could arrange that party. I could do this. And I think as a kid, I certainly was very much someone who was kind of reacted to what other people were doing and was slightly kind of influenced by other people without kind of striking out on my own. And I think that it's no surprise that when I wrote that first book, actually, it was a moment of some crossroads in my life where I moved out of a flat and moved in on my own. And it was the first time I had to sort of be a real grown up and be in charge of everything. And that was the point where I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and do this. I am now going to try and sit down and write a book. And I kind of wished I had that that sort of drive when I was a bit younger and belief. So yeah, it would be something along those lines. That and don't do a cover of Go Fly a Kite in your ska punk band in Warwickshire.
Well, very good, Richard. This has been a fun conversation. I want to say thank you for stopping by Uncorking a Story and letting me uncork yours.
Thanks. Pleasure to have been here.
Thanks for listening to Uncorking a Story. If you'd like more information about today's guest or to find out more about Mike, go to uncorkingastory.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in every week to hear Mike Carlin uncork a new story.